Welcome to Keble College, for those of you who are not familiar with our fantastic college. And I'm very happy to introduce Professor Daniel Javich. I've known Daniel Javich for a long time. I'm not going to tell you he was my supervisor at NYU many years ago, so it's really a great pleasure to be able to have him here at Keble as senior research visitor. Daniel Javich is Emeritus Professor of Comparative Literature. As I said, he taught at NYU most of his life. Maybe he started at Columbia at some point, right? Mm-hmm. Well, he's, as most of you may know, very well known for his research on genre theory, and especially on Ariosto and the reception of the Furioso, the Orlando Furioso, in the second half of the Cinquecento. He wrote quite a lot on that, and just recently he's collected some of these essays on the reception and the composition, actually, the composition of the poem, and have them translated into Italian. Actually, we will be presenting this recent volume next week on Monday at the Italian department, that is, at the Taylorian Institute. So you're all very welcome to come. Besides this, I want to mention his 1991 groundbreaking study of the Furioso, the reception of the Furioso, proclaiming a classic, the canonization of Orlando Furioso. He's also worked on poetry and courtliness. He's edited, that's a very good edition of the Book of the Courtier in the Singleton translation. It's a wonderfully annotated and edited text, which I use a lot with my undergraduate students. Anyway, without further ado, let me welcome Daniel Javich, who will talk to us on one of his favorite topics, chivalric romance and epic, that is specifically how the critique of the Furioso as a romance helped to shape the theory of epic in the second half of the Cinquecento.
Thank you very much, Nicola. I do want to thank Nicola for being a splendid host and cicerone during this stay. And I'd also like to thank Keble College as an entity for its kind reception and providing us with the possibility of a very comfortable stay. Now, I just want to make a couple of comments at the start because it occurred to me that some of you may not be familiar with certain dates. The Orlando Furioso was composed, this is a disputed matter, but was composed around, say, 1504, 1505. The first edition of the poem appeared in 1516, and I'm very pleased to see Marco Dorigatti here, who is the great expert on the 1516 edition. The last version of the Furioso came out in 1532. Now, if you keep these dates in mind, I now want to just mention that the treatises that I'll be talking about in this talk date from, at least in terms of publication, date from 1554 to 1588. So I just want you, right from the beginning, to appreciate this gap. One cannot help being struck by how the development of Italian epic theory is related to the disparagement of chivalric romance that builds up in the middle decades of the 16th century. Although Ariosto's Orlando Furioso is often deemed a superior romance compared to the ones that preceded it, the Furioso is included in the disparagement of the genre and is regularly invoked as an example of what the epic poet ought not to do. Indeed, the norms of epic are initially formulated in attacks against the Orlando Furioso that begin to appear just before 1550. These first attacks against Ariosto's bestseller, which we only know about at second hand, might be said to define epic by negation, dwelling as they do on the failure of the Furioso to observe the epic requisites set down by Aristotle. While the influence of Aristotle's poetics is very discernible in the discourse about epic produced from the mid-century on, Ariosto's deviant practice is, I wish to argue, equally influential and serves to generate rules which counter that practice. In this lecture, I will examine the paradoxical but important role that the Furioso played in the formation of epic theory. It needs to be stated at the outset that aside from the two short chapters on epic in Aristotle's Poetics, the writing about epic I will discuss is the first extensive codification of the genre. We learned from a letter that Giovanni Battista Pigna writes in 1548 to G.B. Giraldi that the Furioso was being discredited by Morditori dell'Ariosto for not being a proper epic poem. Pigna and Giraldi, both Ferrarese men of letters, were among the prominent mid-century champions of Ariosto. The reason given by Ariosto's critics and listed by Pigna for the Furioso's failure as a serious heroic poem were that it lacked unity as well as continuity or coherence. It defied verisimilitude by resorting to the workings of male and female wizards and by the workings of magical weapons. The behavior of its characters often violated decorum. Besides inserting so many long laments of young women in love and making various knights grieve because of love, its author had not chosen an exemplary protagonist, focusing as he had on a wise and valiant man who goes mad. What stirs the critics above all is that instead of having a single plot, Ariosto chose to have many. Consider how many of the objections that I've just given you derive from Aristotle's call for unity, coherence, probability, and appropriate characterization. It is hardly surprising that Pigna sums up the attack by stating that for his critics, the overall failure was that Ariosto departed altogether from Aristotle's poetics. Si è del tutto scostato dalla poetica d'Aristotele. One can infer what requisites have to be met in an epic poem by being told how the Furioso failed to meet them. And most of these requisites agree with what are seen as Aristotle's directives. It's worth remembering that Aristotle's poetics was first assimilated in Italy in the 1540s. The text began to be explained and to have influence toward the end of that decade. The account in Pigna's 1548 letter of critics objecting to the Furioso is one of the first reports of Italian criticism based on Aristotelian grounds. This tendency to to define epic by using the deficiencies of the Furioso and other romanzi as counterexamples recurs in most of the theorizing about epic produced in the second half of the 16th century. But before examining this phenomenon, it should be noted that the attacks the new Aristotelians mounted against the Furioso prompted G.B. Giraldi Cinthio to write his Discorso intorno al compore dei Romanzi and Giovan Battista Pigna to write I Romanzi. These are the first theorizations of the chivalric romance. Giraldi's response, the 1554 Discorso, was the first attempt to formulate a definition of the chivalric romance as a genre quite distinct from ancient epic. Giraldi proposed that the romanzo could not be judged according to ancient epic norms because it was a more modern kind of poetry and observed different formal laws. Giraldi's historicizing of poetic norms was perhaps his most lasting contribution to 16th century theory. Challenging the orthodox classicist view that Aristotle's, and for that matter Horace's, poetic principles, being the product of natural reason, were unchanging and held for all poetic composition. Giraldi argued that such composition was subject to changes as customs and tastes themselves change over time. If, in the present age, romanzatori compose their works according to different poetic norms than those advocated by Horace and Aristotle, it is because these norms conform better to modern taste than the anachronistic ones of ancient epic. The main features of romance that Giraldi sought to justify were its multiplicity of plots and of protagonists, and the relative discontinuity and other peculiar narrative aspects such multiplicity necessitated. According to Giraldi, the copiousness and varietà produced by the many plots and protagonists of chivalric romance were particularly cherished by modern audiences. Pigna's I Romanzi, also first published in 1554, the other pioneering codification of the romance, was also conceived as a rebuttal to the neo-Aristotelian attack against the Furioso. Like Giraldi, Pigna asserted that the romances were composed according to some principles that differed from ancient epic. He distinguished the multiple plot structures and the feigned subject matter of the romanzo from the historical matter and single plot of classical epic. However, Pigna sought to show that as the genre evolved into its superior Italian phase, culminating with the Furioso, it eventually embodied most of Aristotle's criteria for epic poetry. Insofar as the romance is an imitation of heroic actions and deals with matter that is exemplary, marvelous, yet very similar, it is like classical epic. Pigna was much more prone than Giraldi to show that the romanzo, in particular Ariosto's, satisfied Aristotle's prescriptions. And I quote him, "In speaking of romances," he claims at one point, "Aristotle has been our guide, although he never spoke of them." Whereas Giraldi really sought to establish distinctions between the modern romance and the ancient epic, Pigna generalized Aristotelian poetics in such a way as to be able to maintain that the romance could, and in Ariosto's hands, did conform to Aristotle's guidelines. Pigna, nonetheless, distinguished epic and romance as genres. Before I move to epic theory in the 1560s, which will take up most of this talk, I need to make one general observation. Theorizing about epic in the second half of the 16th century could not ignore the tremendous success and reputation of the Furioso, nor, for that matter, the failure of Trissino's epic, L'Italia Liberata dai Goti, a narrative poem poem published in 1547-48, which did try to conform to Homer's example and Aristotle's guidelines. It so happened that the Orlando Furioso enjoyed its greatest success and was being proclaimed the new heroic poem of the age between the 1540s and the 1560s, the same period during which Aristotle's Poetics was entering the mainstream of Italian critical thinking and was being assimilated and conflated with Horace's Ars Poetica to shape the rules of tragedy and epic. This conjunction of the Furioso's success and the rise of Aristotle's authority could not fail to provoke controversy, given that critics perceived that Ariosto's poem flouted what were understood to be Aristotle's prescriptions. The classicists were quick to point out Ariosto's transgressions and to deny the Furioso the elevated status it was being accorded. This critique of the Furioso was rarely found on its own. More often, it was embedded in efforts to define epic poetry. Giraldi's original effort to give the Romanzo a separate generic identity was contested during the next 35 years. The new Aristotelians had to refute his claims because to recognize the chivalric romance as a new genre was to deny a fundamental premise of the classicists, namely that poetic art has universal and unchanging norms. If Aristotle, they maintained, did not include the Romanzo in his generic system, then it simply was not legitimate poetry. Thus, when in the first book of his Arte Poetica, 1564, Antonio Minturno distinguishes the lowly and flawed Romanzo from the higher and proper kind of poetry that is epic, he refuses to grant this inferior form of writing the dignity of a separate generic identity. For Minturno, the Romanzo, including Ariosto's, does not observe rules of its own, but consists rather of transgressions of various unchanging artistic principles which define heroic poetry, for example, unity of action, narrative coherence, continuity, and completeness. Since Minturno highlights coherence and continuity as characteristic features of proper epic, in his critique of the Romanzo, he singles out as one of its principal defects the arbitrary suspensions of narrative that characterize its episodic structure. And he describes how Romance authors drop a plot line at will to shift or return to another in an untimely and disorderly fashion. And I'm just going to quote him here in English. "Time does not allow," he writes, "that when a battle is underway or a storm or some other thing has started, it should be interrupted in the middle, and when the end is most eagerly awaited to abandon it in order to deal with another event which has occurred simultaneously to other persons in other places, as is the peculiar custom of writers of romance who pay no attention to what the time requires, nor to the audience's desire, and thereby annoy rather than please their listeners, because to no one does it reasonably give pleasure when something is interrupted just when it most pleases him." Now, while he's speaking about romanzatori generally, the examples of the sort of untimely and irritating interruptions he mentions bring Ariosto's narrative practice immediately to mind. "Nor do I find it true," Minturno continues, and I'm quoting him, "nor do I find it true that the attention is kindled, but rather that it is extinguished by such interruption, because it is inflamed with a desire to hear the end of the story not when the narrative already begun is abandoned for another, but when the outcome is delayed by many accidents that pertain to the same subject. Minturno, as you can see, does condone episodic digressions from a central action as long as the intervening narrative remains closely linked to that central action. But the romanzatori, Ariosto among them, have no regard for such connection and unity. One could say that Minturno's critique of the discontinuity of romance is inspired by Aristotle's demand that the epic plot be single and the parts integrated into a coherent whole. But what is more noticeable is how such a demand becomes elaborated by dwelling on the counterexample of the romance and of Orlando Furioso in particular. After objecting to the untimely suspension of narrative found in romances, Minturno suggests that epic poets would not shun this sort of suspension if they thought it had any artistic value. He then, and this is quite interesting, he then brings up Virgil's account of Turnus inside the Trojan camp and his escape from it in Aeneid Book 9, maintaining that the Latin poet could have interrupted his account of those exploits of Turnus had he thought it would have produced more pleasure. And I quote him now, "Virgil, for example, could have left Turnus shut up in the Trojan fort and passed to the council and the assembly of the gods, and then returned to liberate Turnus, not without injury to his enemies, if he had thought that leaving off of his narrative could reasonably delight," which clearly Minturno wants to tell us he didn't. Minturno suggests that Virgil did not deem such interruption as satisfying as the continuous account he provides in Aeneid 9. Minturno does so, I would propose, to criticize indirectly Ariosto's fragmentation of his account of Rodomonte inside Paris under siege and his escape, cantos 17 and 18 of the poem, which, as readers knew, was an imitation of Virgil's account of Turnus in Book 9, albeit an imitation that conspicuously defied Virgil's continuity. By being interrupted three times and by coming up as separate episodes in three cantos, Rodomonte's Aristea was deliberately interrupted by different contending plot lines, in effect to produce varietà and a pleasure which Minturno denied. In the larger argument, of which Minturno's attack on the discontinuity of romance is a part, the animus against the genre is made primarily evident by a critique of Ariosto for having opted to compose a romance instead of the proper epic he had the artistic ability to write. One is struck by how much of the discussion in Book 1 of L'Arte Poetica, ostensibly about the principles of proper epic composition, is devoted to Ariosto's failure to follow these principles. Minturno's spokesman in the dialogue keeps asserting that Ariosto could have imitated Homer's example of observing unity of action and could have focused on a single protagonist. However, he refused to do so, and he did so to please the vile multitude. Per piacere a molti, e l'esse di seguire l'abuso che nei romanzi trovava. As a result, he lost the opportunity to belong to the dignified company of epic poets. One senses that Minturno found it easier to define what he took to be the unchanging rules of epic by dwelling on Ariosto's failure to observe them. The most important contribution to epic theory in this period was Tasso's Discorsi dell'arte poetica, only published in 1587, but originally composed between 1562 and 65, about the same time that Minturno's treatise appeared. Tasso shared Minturno's perception that the Romance was a defective kind of poetic composition, and his codification of epic was also impelled by a critique of the Romanzo. In his second Discorso, this critique takes the form of refuting Giraldi's legitimation of the chivalric romance on the grounds that it is different from traditional epic poetry. According to Tasso, the confusing multiplicity, the excessive length, the absence of beginnings and ends, the discontinuity of both Boiardo's and Ariosto's romances are not, pace Giraldi, formal features of the Romanzo as an independent genre. They are structural flaws inherent in episodic narratives that refuse to observe classical, that is, proper norms of unity and continuity. While Tasso acknowledged the success of Orlando Furioso, his theory did not fail to indicate how badly Ariosto put together his poem. Ariosto's name and the defects of his romance come up explicitly in the second discourse devoted to epic structure. But from the beginning of Tasso's treatise, the romance is discredited, albeit implicitly. Readers would know that the subject matter of epic should be based on true history, not on the fictive made-up matter used by romance writers. Tasso states that it is more preferable for the poet to resort to history because it makes it easier to observe verisimilitude. Moreover, the epic poet has to turn to history, Tasso maintains, because the epic deals, or should deal, with actions so illustrious and memorable that they cannot have been left unchronicled. That historical record has to be the basis of the epic plot. The critique of the Romanzo's deficiencies in Tasso's Discorsi cloaks the extent to which the more pleasurable features of romance, the features that appeal to a modern audience, affect Tasso's guidelines. Thus, Tasso's concern with the marvelous aspects of the epic plot is in part prompted by the marvelous fantasies that made the Romanzo so appealing. On the one hand, when he insists on the need for the epic poet to observe verisimilitude and credibility, he is implicitly objecting to the far-fetched and incredible exploits that often characterize knightly adventures in chivalric romance. On the other hand, he also acknowledges that an epic will offer too little delight that does not include supernatural wonders, and he calls upon the poet to season, condire, his poem with such marvels. To be sure, Tasso does require that such marvels remain believable, an effect the poet can secure by making their divine causes evident and acceptable to orthodox Christian belief. For all his preoccupation with maintaining credibility, Tasso's notion of the Christian marvelous still permits the poet to import basic ingredients of romance by allowing for the inclusion of magic and enchantment. It has to be said that the divine apparatus Tasso wants the poet to provide as the cause of the marvelous is not generally present in chivalric romance, in earlier chivalric romances, which resort often to magic, but are not very concerned about its provenance. Still, Tasso's argument that meraviglie are legitimate as long as their divine causes are made evident and acceptable to orthodox opinion is a way, however scrupulous, of letting in through the window the marvels of romance that get shut out of the front door. Tasso's request that the epic subject be based in history is qualified when he maintains at the beginning of the second discourse that the epic poet has the license to modify or supplement history, as, for example, Virgil had done. Still, he remains very attached to the idea of history as a control for poetry. Poetic license, however, he writes, must not be extended so far that the poet dare to change completely the ultimate conclusion of the actions he chooses to treat, or even some of those principal and better known incidents already accepted as true by popular report. He would display such audacity who described Rome as conquered and Carthage as conqueror. Homer's audacity would be the same if that were true, which some say falsely, that the Greeks were routed, that Troy was victorious, and that Penelope was a whore. Che I Greci rotti e che Troia vittrice e che Penelopea fu meretrice. These lines, as some of you must know, come from the passage of in the 35th canto of Orlando Furioso, when during their visit to the moon, St. John tells Astolfo that the epic poets altered the truth to serve their interests and those of generous patrons, and then asserts that contrary to what is represented in the Iliad and the Odyssey, the truth was that the Greeks were routed, that Troy was victorious, and that Penelope was a whore. And in the next octave, St. John maintains that Dido was actually chaste and that her bad reputation was due to Virgilian malice. Clearly, Tasso wanted to deny Ariosto's, or rather St. John's, claim that the ancient epic poems were so inauthentic. If that were so, Tasso goes on to state, then this, quote, robs poetry of that authority which comes to it from history and which moves us to conclude that the theme of epic poetry must be based on some history. Tasso clearly believed, unlike Ariosto, that history possessed a truth value and an authority that it could confer on poetry. Moreover, historical facts and outcomes serve to control the imaginative flights of poets so that episodes like Astolfo's voyage to the moon would no longer be permissible. In the second discourse, he goes on to refer critically to Boiardo's and Ariosto's poems when he speaks of the need for the epic plot to be whole or entire, that is, to have a beginning, middle, and an end. The Furioso, according to Tasso, has no proper beginning, and Boiardo's no end, even though it should be said that Tasso acknowledges that death may have prevented Boiardo from bringing his work to an end. After wholeness, he takes up the size of the epic. That poem is suitably large, Tasso maintains, in which the memory does not darken or fail, but taking the whole in at once, can consider how one thing connects with another and depends on a third, and how the parts are in proportion to themselves and to the whole. Think how this last directive counters the disconnected, intertwined plot lines of the oversized Furioso, a design that deliberately prevents the reader from taking the whole in at once, to quote Tasso, and that obscures the possible relation of its parts. Tasso then brings up the all-important requisite of unity, which prompts him to review the debate between proponents of unity versus defenders of multiplicity, and he defies critics like Giraldi, who claim that the Romanzo observes different rules of composition than classical epic. Tasso is not digressing, since his refutation of Giraldi not only undermines the effort to legitimize the Furioso on grounds of difference, it allows Tasso to reassert that epic and chivalric romance belong to the same genre. Though more polemical, Tasso's view that the Romanzo does not constitute a separate poetic genre was shared by contemporary codifiers of epic. They all considered the Romance as an inferior, deficient, and deviant sort of writing, of which a properly constructed and ordered epic is the legitimate, more perfect form. Time doesn't really allow me to do full justice to Tasso's subtle critique of the Furioso. In Discourse 3, for instance, devoted to the magnificent style that should characterize epic, he points out from the beginning that the middle style prevalent in the Furioso is beneath the high style expected of epic. Tasso implies that his guidelines for achieving an illustrious style are never followed by Ariosto, and as a result, the style of the Furioso cannot serve as any kind of example for the would-be epic poet. Minturno's and Tasso's view that the modern romance is a defective and transgressive kind of heroic composition was reiterated by neo-Aristotelians for the next two decades. By the time, however, that Camillo Pellegrino reasserts this view in his 1584 dialogue, Il Caraffa, ovvero della poesia epica, the lowly and vulgar romanzo is given a more specific profile. Il Caraffa was the first published work that championed Tasso's Gerusalemme Liberata and claimed that in comparison to Ariosto's Furioso, Tasso's work was a far superior epic poem. By clearly championing Tasso over Ariosto, Pellegrino sparked off a critical debate between the Ariostisti and the Tassisti that lasted until after the end of the century. Pellegrino argued that Ariosto chose to write a popular romance instead of an epic, echoing a little bit what we saw in Minturno, and given the inferiority of that type of writing, he could not have hoped to achieve Tasso's degree of honor in epic poetry. As he distinguishes the romance from epic to establish its inferiority, Pellegrino singles out the following features: its imitation of many actions and of many protagonists, including wicked and immoral ones, its completely false stories, its lack of gravity, its unconnected digressions, and in general, its confusing lack of unity. These features are all deemed defective, but they begin to constitute a generic definition nonetheless. Quite unlike Giraldi's definition of romance, which aimed to affirm the legitimacy of the modern counterpart of epic, Pellegrino's definition aims to show every way the Romanzo fails to conform to the perennial norms of epic formulated by Aristotle. We have seen that this kind of criticism had been leveled at chivalric romance for over three decades. But rather than merely objecting about the failure of the Romanzo to satisfy epic norms, Pellegrino now has Tasso's poem to invoke as proof that these norms can be admirably fulfilled in modern Italian poetry. Not only does Pellegrino dwell on Ariosto's failure to achieve the merits of the Gerusalemme Liberata, but on several counts, he faults Ariosto for doing the very opposite of what the ancients prescribed. Let me use one example. Instead of observing, as Tasso does, Aristotle's demand for the plot to be such that due to its unity and coherence, it will be intelligible as a whole, Ariosto's plot is a mostro di più capi e di diverse membra non ordinate, a monster with many heads and of different limbs, lacking order. In the replica, Pellegrino eventually wrote in rebuttal of Leonardo Salviati's first defense of the Furioso, which I'll come to very shortly. Pellegrino elaborated this criticism by claiming that neither the middle nor the end of the Furioso is dependent on what precedes it. These flaws, he concludes, simply reconfirm what he must keep on repeating, namely that the poem ha molte imperfezioni come epico, ma è perfettissimo come romanzo, has many imperfections as an epic, but is absolutely perfect as a romance. Pellegrino's opponents were quick to perceive that by categorizing Ariosto as a mere romanzatore in comparison to a true epic poet like Tasso, Pellegrino was trying to disqualify Orlando Furioso as heroic poetry, and they fought back. Pellegrino's main opponent in this debate was Leonardo Salviati. His response in defense of Ariosto was published anonymously in several tracts, beginning with a Difesa dell'Orlando Furioso contra il dialogo dell'epica poesia di Camillo Pellegrino, 1584, and culminating in the Infarinato Secondo, 1588. Given the limits of this paper, I can only consider Salviati's efforts to refute the distinctions between romance and epic that he found in Pellegrino's dialogue. Salviati realized that the debate about the merits of Ariosto's Romanzo centered around the issue of whether it was a different kind of poem from the epic defined by Aristotle and embodied in Homer's and Virgil's Practice. Salviati's strategy was to marshal every possible argument to show that there was no such difference. The first thrust was to argue that the Romanzo and the epic constitute the same genre. We saw that Tasso had made a similar argument, but one of the reasons Salviati asserted such generic sameness was to allow him to claim that the Furioso met Aristotle's requirements for epic, not, as in the case of Tasso, to show how defective a version of epic romance was. To further challenge Pellegrino's claim that unlike the matter of epic, the matter of romance included unworthy deeds enacted by morally dubious characters, Salviati reminds his opponent that Homer similarly included vile individuals along with higher-ranking protagonists. Actually, one of Salviati's most original strategies was to illustrate how similar Ariosto's Romanzo was to the canonical epics of antiquity by showing that most of the so-called imperfections of the Orlando Furioso were also recognizable features of Homer's and Virgil's heroic poems. Thus, against the charge that the Romanzo lacked the unity, both formal and thematic, that characterizes epic poetry, Salviati quite effectively demonstrates that the ancient epics possessed within their unified plots much the same sort of multiplicity castigated in the Furioso. Salviati also refutes the charge that Ariosto violated the Aristotelian demand for unity by arguing that Aristotle had a different standard of unity for epic than he did for tragedy. He even provides a graphic illustration of the almond-shaped structure of a properly designed epic plot filled out in the middle by the breadth and variety of material called for by Aristotle. According to Salviati, such amplitude is the virtu propria of the heroic poem, whereas the thinness of the single plot desirable in tragedy is a flaw in epic. Ariosto's plot, he then shows, conforms to the precepts of unity that he, Salviati, has derived from Aristotle. Salviati made a valiant effort to assert the Furioso's legitimacy as an epic poem and to negate the opposition of romance and epic that Ariosto's critics used to disqualify the Furioso as heroic poetry. The opposition of romance and epic, however, was a notion that was not to be dislodged. Ironically, it was to a large extent the Furioso itself that was responsible for theoretical notions about epic and romance to emerge and then to come into opposition. The un-Aristotelian character of Ariosto's best-selling poem made it at once the object of hostile criticism and also proof of the viability of its post-classical form. That brought about, first, the idea of an alternative between epic and romance, and then of an opposition between the two genres. We must bear in mind that while the Furioso played a key role in establishing the idea of epic versus romance, Ariosto himself did not have to confront that opposition. When he composed his poem, some 50 years before the treatises on romance and epic began to appear, he did not have to deal with Aristotelian prescriptions and the idea of the romanzo as a sort of narrative poetry in opposition to the epic. A number of influential contemporary interpreters of the Furioso have projected on the poem some sort of large-scale opposition of romance and epic. This, as I've argued elsewhere, is not only anachronistic, but it ascribes to Ariosto intentions that were not really there. Patricia Parker, the first critic to employ the idea that Ariosto's poem is marked by a tension between its romance divagations and its epic teleology, actually admitted her anachronism. She stated that she was inspired for her approach by the epic versus romance opposition formulated by late 16th century critics of the romanzo. Not that they weren't epic aspects to Ariosto's poem, but they weren't there to produce some overarching dialectic between epic and romance. Ariosto's inclusion of epic matter, comedic matter, or novellas in verse, attested to the capaciousness of the romanzo cavalleresco. Also, Boiardo's and Ariosto's chivalric romances reflect a much more ecumenical conception of heroic poetry, one that could conjoin the military epic matter of Carolingian gesta with the solitary knightly quests of Arthurian romance, and that conjunction could take place unproblematically, that is, without the concerns about generic orthodoxy and purity that would present themselves when genres became more codified and therefore separated from one another. I want to close, it's almost an aside, but I want to close by reminding you of the long-lasting effect of the definitions of epic I've examined, especially of the binary opposition between epic and romance that marks these definitions. The fact that the modern critics I've just referred to still stick to such an opposition is itself a sign of the tenacity of this concept forged in the latter half of the Cinquecento. But I'm also thinking of the way the term romanzo can't seem to shake off the sense of inferiority it acquired because of the Aristotelian critique of it in comparison to orthodox epic. One even finds today that it can be problematic to use the label romanzo or romance because of the connotations it has acquired. It continues to retain, to some degree, the sense of being opposed to neo-Aristotelian notions of epic acquired, as I've tried to show, in the latter part of the Cinquecento.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.